Well, you're coming to St. Charles this weekend, and I'm just wondering, what are people going to see there?
First of all, I'll be there in person. I exist as a physical being. That's first. And what I do is I'm talking about the radio show. I'm talking about why we're making a radio show that is so different from pretty much everything else on the radio. And a lot of it is just an excuse to play funny clips from the show. Like that's a huge part of it is playing really funny old clips from stories. And I stand on stage with an iPad where I can fire music and the sound and the quotes, and I can basically create the sound of the radio show around me as I speak and try to demonstrate these things.
One thing I wanted to get out of the way is, what is the question people ask you most frequently when you're out in public?
I mean, when I give a talk, often the question that I get in every from the audience afterwards is about the music that we use in the radio show. Just because as I'm there on stage, I'm scoring what I'm doing live, and people ask about the music, and I talk about how we use music and our approach to music. That's sort of hard to answer for you now without actually playing some music and demonstrating it. And beyond that, I feel like this is a really good example of a question from an interviewer that's better than any answer I have.
And how has your show transitioned or evolved over the years? And what effect do you think that's had on the sound of radio?
I mean, our show, you know, has gone through a couple of changes. I mean, one of the big ones is that when we started, it was really applying the tools of journalism to everyday stories, to very personal stories that were much more personal than most journalists would do. And then over the years, you know, the big change that we've gone through is actually just applying these kinds of storytelling tropes or tools or something to just the same kinds of news stories that other people do. And so we'll tackle a news story, but try to give it the sort of characters and emotional moments and funny moments and story arcs and story surprises, plot surprises that we have in most of the stories on the show. And that's just an enormously interesting and very difficult thing to try to do. So that's been the big change. And in terms of just, you know, how I think it's influenced public radio, I mean, I think that there are – like the style of thing that we're doing has always been – one of the things that's done in public radio. I think just you know, This American Life has just been a very visible example of it every week. And I think that, you know, what it's done is that there are more people trying stories like this and making stories like the ones that we make. I mean, still, I don't feel like in any way is it like the dominant thing you hear when you turn on public radio. But it's like just something you hear a little more often.
Yeah, and I've encountered many aspiring radio personalities over the years who come to our station. They want to jump in and do radio the This American Life way. Any advice for them?
I mean, my first piece of advice would be that they would just start right now. You know, just start. I think a lot of times when people want to do some sort of creative work or want to do reporting, like they're waiting for permission from somebody to do it. And I think like the first thing is like you don't need permission. You can just start making it. I mean, radio is the tech is simple enough that anybody listening to us could learn it in a couple of days. And you know, my main advice to anybody who's trying to do it would be to amuse yourself. Like I think all these kinds of stories get better if the people making them are actually truly curious about you know, the people who they're interviewing, and that they, when things seem funny, they act like they're funny, and when things are moving, like they let themselves be moved by it and move towards that work. And so I think when it comes to especially something like public broadcasting and public radio journalism, it's such a, you know, people take it so seriously that and the standards are very, very high, that one of the things that doesn't get said to young people is like, oh, also you're supposed to have fun. Like also like you should it's okay for you to be obsessed. Like it's okay for you to be in it for your own amusement. Like I think actually that is the thing that I think is like a missing X ingredient that doesn't get said enough.
That is so much better than my learn to write first, kid, advice. So
is that what you were told?
No, that's really? What I tell them.
Really?
A little bit of that, yeah. I'll confess.
I think a little bit of that. Sure, I don't argue with that. I don't argue with that. I would say like even before they write, if they could just edit, because I was a terrible writer for years, but I was a decent editor, audio editor. And so my whole early career, like I don't appear in it. Like you don't hear my voice at all because I'm terrible. That's another thing I play. I'll be playing on stage is just some of the early work I did before I could really, before I knew what I was doing. And I don't appear in that work at all.
I think a big misconception then is when you bring up editing is how important editing is. I think that's something people don't understand about the difficulty in making radio is the editing.
I think weirdly, like when somebody sees television, you can sense the amount of money and production that goes into it. Whereas radio, just because it sounds, when it's done well, it just sounds like, oh, there's a bunch of people talking. You don't have a sense of just how highly and aggressively edited something is. And especially in a show like ours, where we're really trying to make conversations hit their plot points in very precise ways. And so, you know, I'll talk to somebody for an hour and we'll cut it down to, you know, 7 or 8 minutes where every plot point hits in a really perfect way. It's very much an invisible process.
What's the hardest thing about your job?
The hardest thing about my job is just the volume of it. Like, there's just a lot of it. There's just like a lot to do all the time. So it's like having a meal that I enjoy, but it's just an uncomfortably large meal every day. And especially in the last few years where truthfully, like the staff of This American Life is so incredibly skilled that doing the radio show is it's not easy. Like, it's still very hard. Like, this week is really going to – like, I'm talking to you in a week where this week is just a very hard show to put together for a bunch of reasons. But everybody's so good at their jobs. It's so much easier than it used to be. And in the wake of that, what we've and the problem now is that we end up taking on so many extra projects. Like, over the summer and fall, we filmed and edited a feature film. And then right now, you know, this week, I'm getting ready, in addition to doing the regular radio show, for this cinema event that we're doing on May 10th, where we're doing our show on stage and beaming it into movie theaters around the country. And I feel like without those extra things, my life would actually be kind of a breeze.
Yes.
Have you ever thought about being all in the family of radio and just spinning some of the stuff off? You've got a lot of talented people there.
No, we never did until this past year. We have an idea for a show based on one of our episodes that could be its own separate show. And it's a show – we did an episode of our show where we basically did a news show in our style. Like, we basically – the entire show did, you know, like what Weekend Edition does, where it sort of summarizes the week's news and covers it. But the way that we did it was all stories in the style that we do them. And at the end of that, I felt like, oh, this could be its own program if we wanted to go out and raise the money and hire staff and do all that work. But we've actually had a number of talks about it. And periodically I'll meet somebody and I try to talk them into taking it over and doing that as a spinoff from our show. But I can never find anybody to do that.
You write an interesting line between journalism and storytelling, and of course, they cross over everywhere. Your show does, but how do you distinguish between the two on your show? You know, sometimes storytelling is fiction, and sometimes storytelling is news.
I mean, generally, unless otherwise labeled, the stories on our show are true, and we treat them as reporting, even if they're reporting about very small personal moments in a person's life. And then occasionally there's a piece of fiction that we like that we'll put on the show. And then I feel like there are these contributors who fall into a gray area, like David Sedaris, where he's a professional humorist. And so we assume that the audience knows that he'll be exaggerating for comic effect. You know, you can tell as a listener that when he comes on, it's very different than when one of us, you know, goes to Congress and interviews congressmen about money. Like, you can tell that what he's doing is not reporting. And truthfully, we've talked lately about whether or not we should label it as such. But so far, I feel like we haven't done that.
Would you have a sounder, you know, coming up? Here's some fiction. Here's some.
I mean, truthfully, like we just went through this thing with Mike Daisy where we put a story on the radio that had been something that somebody had performed in the theater, where he sort of turned himself into an amateur investigative reporter and went to China and tried to figure out what was going on inside the factories that produce Apple's products, the computers and iPods and iPads and iPhones. And it turned out that things that he had said to us basically we learned that things that he had said to us during the fact-checking process and we learned that the story wasn't true and we had to retract it. And in the wake and truthfully, we could have done a better job vetting it. And we did an entire episode of our show about this. So I'm not sure even how much to say about it here because I feel like maybe people have already heard me talk about this at extreme length. But in the wake of Mike Daisy, where we came out of it as a staff, is that the next time we would have a David Sedaris piece on, we would either fact check like a regular story, like a regular piece of reporting, like when David is in the New Yorker, they'll fact check his work. And we decided, well, let's just start doing that now with everything. And that's definitely will be a change for us. Like up until now, like that kind of stuff, we didn't give it the burden of journalism. But I feel like the thing that I saw in the wake of Mike Daisy is that as we've become a more journalistic product, it seems like it would be more appropriate to do that, and that people are turning to us for stories that are true. And not just stories that are fun to listen to. And since the overwhelming majority of them are true in, you know, the 100% literal sense, it seems like it's not very hard for us to see that everything is. And then occasionally, if there's something that's a piece of fiction, then we'll just label it as such. And so that's a change that's recent.
That's pretty huge. And did you ever foresee this coming to this? Because it does seem like the show used to be more, there was more fiction. But now it just seems like, to me at least, it seems like there's much more of a journalism bent to it.
It seems huge to me, too. I mean, I think in practice it's actually not going to be so different. I mean, I think David's stories are largely true. And you know, when he's asked about it, the thing that he always says is that, like, they're true enough for you, you know? and obviously, like, they must be largely true because they go into The New Yorker, which is a fact-checked, thoroughly fact-checked magazine. So I think in practice it's just going to be a little extra work, and I don't think it's actually going to change very much what happens on the air. I never thought it would come to this. No, this is news. This is all new.
Is that the most important thing that you learned from the whole Mike Daisy incident?
I mean, that's definitely the biggest, I mean, that's the change that we're making. You know, that in cases like that, we things were in an ambiguous area that we've decided to make utterly unambiguous as we go forward. I mean, it's funny, like the Mike Daisy thing was such a hard thing for all of us to go through. And we have always been a pretty aggressive fact-checking staff when it came to the journalism. And now, and even with Mike Daisy's piece, I mean, you know, we spent weeks actually looking into whether that story was true and confirming with a dozen people in China and people who are familiar with how Apple's operations run, people who have firsthand knowledge, people who have been into those factories, that the things that he was saying about Apple were true. You know, but the problem was that we trusted him on a number of things, and the one in particular, like we trusted him when he told us that his translator was unreachable, and we couldn't confirm with her that the things that he said happened, that he met these people, that he went to these places, that he observed these things with his own eyes. Like those things were not true, and we should not have trusted him. And when we couldn't confirm them, when we couldn't talk to somebody independently who was there with him. You know, I mean, now we would just, that would obviously never happen again. We would never make that mistake again. And so I feel like in a situation like that, where, you know, I think there's a level of confirming things that, you know, in that case that just, you know, we would just not make that mistake again.
When it comes down to the people who are directly affected by what this piece was about, the people who actually work in these factories, is this a positive or negative?
I mean, I think that Mike Daisy's story that we broadcast, you know, across the country. It was one of a number of very high profile stories about Apple and its manufacturing practices in China that all came in January. And it's obvious that Apple took that and most especially, I think, the New York Times front page investigative series about the practices in China. It you know, Apple took that as a shot in the arm to take action. And in the wake of that, allowed an independent group into those factories, into Foxconn, the manufacturer that we talked about and that the New York Times wrote about, let them in there to actually observe firsthand what's going on and where there are problems and where there are not problems. And it seems like that Apple has really stepped up in response, not especially to Mike Daisy alone, but into kind of the combination of Mike Daisy and the New York Times and a number of other things that happened in January. And so, and you know, in that way, it's a positive thing, I suppose. I still think, you know, if I had it to do again, I wouldn't have put it on the radio. Like, I don't think that was in any way acceptable.
And on to a lighter question. What entertains you these days?
I mean, honestly, it's been funny. It's been a period where I was watching a lot of TV a few years back, and I feel like there aren't that many shows that I'm liking that much right now. And so really, like, I have like one or two TV shows. I'm watching 30 Rock. I'm watching I'm starting up the new season of Mad Men, but not feeling very optimistic about it. And then really beyond that, I have no time for anything else. Literally, that there's that hour and a half of television a week. And then because we've been putting together this live show, and because before that we were finishing a movie, I've literally not had any free time. And when I do, the only thing I really read is my wife edits a website that her boss is a 15-year-old girl in the suburbs of Chicago named Tavi Gevinson, and they who started this website for teenage girls called Rookie at rookiemag.com, and I'll go there to keep up with what's being written there, and I'm enjoying that, but yeah.
And just so you know, by the third episode of Mad Men this year, it's back on track, I think.
Oh, is that true?
It's getting back on track. Yes, so yeah, stay with it and, you know, waste your hour there, and I guess you make your own entertainment then. So
there's not that much entertainment. I have a dog. I walk the dog every day. I play with the dog. I chat with my wife. That's about it.
Well, what's your next exciting project?
I mean, honestly, like the cinema thing that we're doing May 10th is a real mind-bending challenge, because we're doing a show where we're trying to make it as visual as humanly possible. And so over the weekend, we shot a short movie with Mike Birbiglia, this comedian who's been on the show. We shot, like, it was a full-scale movie production for 2 days. And I'm working with all these visual artists who are doing things that'll be in the show at different points and getting the stories edited. And it's just a massive project. We have dancers. It's quite a thing that I'm very excited to put on. And truthfully, like, this is like the sort of thing where, like, there were a bunch of points where I could get out of it. Like, there were points like 4 or 5 months ago where it's like, should we really do this? Oh, it's gonna be so hard and this and that, and it's gonna make my life really, really busy. And then at every stage, I just felt like, no, it's going to be really cool. Like, I think it's just going to be cool. And then you just feel like such a dumbass to be motivated by something so simple. You know what I mean? I feel like my entire motivation is just like, it just seems like this would be fun to do. And so let's just do it, even though it's going to be really, really make our lives, all of our lives here, very, very hard for a couple of weeks. So I hope it works out.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for talking to me.